You're the first speaker in this year's series. What advice do you have for engaging in effective dialogue around politics on American campuses?
I would start with listening, right? Everyone always, you know, we get this question at Pod Save America shows all the time, which is, you know, it's Thanksgiving's coming up, my Trump supporting uncle is gonna be there, what can I tell him to convince him to not be a Trump supporter? The answer is probably nothing. But the question people should be asking is not what should I say, right? It's how should I listen? And I think that's the big thing that we need to do, is listen to people to try to understand why they think the way they do, right? Like what has led, what life experiences, what positions have led them to feel the way they feel about whatever the issue is, whether it's political or something else, because there's too much talking and not enough listening. This is not just a problem on college campuses. This is America writ large in the age of Twitter and Facebook.
So too much talking, not much listening. You co-host a podcast, which is a lot of talking.
It is, yes.
How does that help the civil dialogue that's occurring in this nation?
I mean, to be honest, civil, I don't think, well, let me put it this way. We are fortunate enough to have a platform, right? And so what is the way in which we can use that platform to be helpful, right? And so I am less, civility is good. People should be polite to each other. We should not yell at each other, not harass each other. But I'm more interested in activism than I am in civility. Civility for civility's sake is submission, in my view, right? Like, our podcast is not about how do we get people to be nice to each other. It is helping people who are concerned about the direction of this country find positive, productive ways to channel their anger. So instead of, like, to go back to the hypothetical example of the Trump-loving uncle, so I will often tell people, instead of just listening, which you should listen, but if you can't convince your Trump-loving uncle or father or whoever else, like, don't worry about trying to convince them to stop loving Trump. Go find two of your friends who aren't registered to vote, register them to vote, and now you've canceled their vote, right? So it is about, instead of like planning out how you're gonna yell at your uncle, find out how you can advance the thing you care about by actually doing the substantive work of political activism.
Well, and so the big part of this year's theme is bringing voices from both the left and the right. So you're obviously coming from the left.
Yep.
You mentioned civility and activism. How do you balance, can you balance both of those things?
Yes, I mean, I think whether you liked President Obama or not, he was a civil human being, right? He was a decent human being. He treated people with decency, right? You can be involved, like, activism doesn't involve yelling at anyone. That's actually counterproductive to activism. Activism is trying to get people to get involved in politics, right? To be a force multiplier for citizenship. And, like, the best way to do that is civil, right? You're never going to yell someone into doing what you want to do. And so, like, we've had a lot of civility debates in Washington since Trump took over. I think they generally sort of miss the point, right? I think the more important thing is, how can you actually make a difference? And you're gonna have a better chance of making a difference by being a civil, decent person with an open heart and open ears than you are just screaming at the person down the street. I think that's counterproductive. That is a waste of time in a world of limited time and resources and really urgent priorities.
Do you think it's about an authenticity? I mean, there's something about Trump that seems authentic to a lot of mm-hmm. voters. There's something about Obama that seemed very authentic to a lot of Democratic voters. So where does authenticity fit?
I think authenticity is the most important quality for a politician. Like, voters have a very good BS detector. The voters who supported Trump did not have the wool pulled over their eyes. They knew exactly what they were doing and who they were voting for. They may not have agreed with everything he said or did, but they made a judgment that he was who they wanted to support based on who he was. And when I meet with candidates or we're sussing out like who would be a good presidential candidate, one of the first questions that I ask myself is, does this person seem comfortable in their own skin? Are they comfortable being who they are? And the candidates who are comfortable being who they are also the candidates who are comfortable losing, right? Like, that is, like, are you willing to lose? Obama had this, a lot of politicians are basically in politics to fill some sort of insecure void in their life, right? That you want the approbation of an election or the applause at a rally. Trump, there's certainly some of that with Trump for sure, but he doesn't hide it, right? He is wearing the insecurities on his sleeves for everyone to see. Obama was interesting in the sense that he, if you ever read his first book, Dreams of My Father, he went through a search for his own identity at a young age in his life. And it really changed his life, because he was, as he would be the first to tell you, a bit wayward. May have, you know, dabbled in some things he shouldn't have dabbled in, that are now completely legal in many states, in high school and college. But once he sort of went into understand his relationship with his father and who he was, he became very comfortable in his own skin, and that, I think, drove a lot of his political success. It made him authentic to people, and that helped for sure.
Well, let's jump into 2020. We have, what is it, 20 candidates? Or 19?
They're dropping out like flies, but I think we're down to like 18 or something.
On the Democratic side, it's a historic number. We had a historic number of Republicans in the last go-round. What do you think is the most important message for a candidate who wants to stand out from the crowd? In this, we've got a debate coming up on Friday, or next Friday.
Yep.
What's the most important message you think that a Democrat needs to send?
I think the best message for a Democrat is someone who can talk about in a clear, concise, understandable way about how we got to this moment that we're in right now, and that our democracy is under a very true threat that goes beyond Trump. That Trump is actually the symptom of a larger disease that afflicts our American politics. And the people who can capture that moment, who can talk about the fact that we live in a country where 90% of people want background checks, but they can't get a vote in the Senate, understand how we got to that point, can talk about voter suppression, billionaires buying our elections, that sort of stuff, is the one who's gonna have the most powerful message.
All right, well,
I'm waiting for the person to do that.
You're waiting for that
yes.
person? Who do you think's most likely to do that among this crew?
I think so far, the candidates who have had the most success doing that are Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren.
All right.
Now, the caveat I would give for all of this is that at this point in 2007, Hillary Clinton was beating Barack Obama by 30 points. And at this point in 2003, Joe Lieberman, stalwart Democrat that he is, was leading the Democratic primary, and John Kerry, our eventual nominee, was in fourth. So there's a lot of road to go here.
Right. Is it somehow like, are we jumping ahead of the game trying to predict things now? There's so many polls out, so many things out about what we think about these candidates now, but everything changes, as you just mentioned. Is polling now kind of a distraction from the real issues?
Yes. I mean, there's a poll out today about Wisconsin, and it has Joe Biden beating Donald Trump by like 8 points in Wisconsin, and Bernie Sanders beating by like 6, and Elizabeth Warren is tied, and Kamala Harris is like winning or losing by 1 point, something like that. We're like, oh my God, what does this mean? It means literally nothing. And it's driven by like two things. One is progressives, we're so nervous. Like, this is the most important election that we will probably face in our lifetimes. And we want to know right now who the best person is, who can accomplish this, who can take on the task. We want to know right this second. And we don't have enough information to make that judgment. The other reason is just there's sort of a political media industrial complex now that is like the presidential campaign is keeping newspapers and cable networks afloat. And so they're fueling this as well. And so we're sort of living in a world of national hysteria with little consequence just yet.
That's a great segue into a question. What I like to do in these events is National Agenda is also a class with 20 plus students, and they are required to submit questions. So I like to ask their questions at these events as well. Brian wants to know, what do you think will be the media strategy of the Trump administration going into the 2020 presidential election? Do you think it's gonna be similar to what we saw in 2016, or is it gonna be different?
I think it is gonna be very similar. And Trump has two political imperatives, if you look at it right now. One is he wants to incite his base as much as possible. He needs to turn out to be as high as humanly possible from his most rabid supporters. But he also has never polled above 46%. And so he needs to destroy the Democratic nominee to the point that enough voters will either stay home or vote for some sort of third-party candidate. Like, he was able to win in some of these states at 46% in 2016. And he needs to do that again. He's the only president in the history of polling who has never been above, he's never been more, his favorability has never been higher than his unfavorability. He's never hit 50%. He can win that way, he absolutely can, but he can only do that by driving the favorability of the Democrat down, which is what he did with Hillary Clinton. And I think it's clearly what he's gonna try to do again. Probably through some sort of fairly unclever nickname.
Well, I've apparently lost all of my notes since we've been talking.
All right, so let's just freestyle.
So I will go to your book that you just recently, if my thing will work here.
It sounds like the Russians.
So you released a book last year called Yes, We Still Can. Why do you feel hopeful about where we're going in a post-Obama Trump era as a Democrat?
The Trump's election is obviously a very, very dark cloud from my perspective. But I have been able somehow, which is not really I'm usually more of a glass half empty sort of guy, but I have found a silver lining in this dark cloud, which is Trump's election has awakened something in the American people. I remember the day after the inauguration, walking out of the hotel in D.C. I was hiding in while I was there to do political commentary, hiding from all of the people in the soon-to-be CAG hats. And I walked outside the day after, and the streets are filled with the Women's March. People like grandmothers, daughters, granddaughters who've come across the country on buses overnight to march. I remember after a few weeks later, at the last minute, getting in Lyft and going to the San Francisco airport to participate in the protests against the Muslim ban. My wife and I were the third people in a row that the Lyft driver had driven to the airport, and there were almost 1,000 people there cheering. You know, one of the wonderful things about Pod Save America is we travel the country, and everywhere we go, we get to meet some of these amazing activists, people like, you know, we've spent a lot of time with the kids from Parkland who will make you feel so good about America. We got to spend time with a man named Addie Barkin who has a terminal disease and is using every last ounce of his strength to fight for Medicare for All. And you get to meet these activists and you see that the country is better than what happened in 2016. And it's my book. I wanted to be hopeful. I am hopeful, but it is conditional hope. I am not telling everyone. The point of this book is not to tell people it's going to be okay. Trump's going to lose. We're going to get over this. It's not that, because it may not go that direction. But I do believe that we control our own fate. If we do what we did in 2018, which is people march, they register people to vote, they knock on doors, they make phone calls, and they vote, like, there are more people who disagree with Trump than support him, who agree with the Obama's vision of politics. And if those people turn out and become active, full-time citizens, then the future of this country is very hopeful.
Well, so your book also talks about what Democrats need to do, what they need to change if they do want to win in the next presidential election. Yeah. What are your best pieces of advice for a Democrat who ultimately wins the primary?
First is they have to be willing to, you have to be willing to run to win, not to lose. Too many politicians are afraid of losing. They're more afraid of losing than they want to win. And so that leads to caution all the time. Trump is favored to win this election. Incumbents almost always win. Incumbents in good economies always win. And so this is an uphill battle for us. It is a very winnable election, but we have to recognize that we're going to have to go all out to do it. There is no cautious approach to get it. Like, you're gonna have to put all the chips in the middle of the table and go for it. So no risk aversion. Second thing is experimentation. I've been in politics 20 years. The structure of the modern campaign is mostly the same today as it was when I got into politics in the late 90s. It is still fundamentally centered around television ads, mail, pieces of paper delivered by car to people's homes, and phone calls to landlines. So I often go to, the problem with this is, the key for Democrats to win is turning out young people. So whenever I go to see a group of young people, I ask them, when was the last time they watched a television commercial? Right? Like, never. When was the last time you checked your mail? And when was the last time you answered a phone call from an unknown number? Right? Like, that is just not, like, we have to update the model of campaigns to succeed. And the last piece of advice I would give the Democrat is, traditionally, elections against an incumbent are supposed to be referendums, right? Like, the goal, your goal the whole time is to say, I want the people to decide whether they like Trump or not. If they don't like Trump, they're going to elect me. I think that is a terrible mistake this time. right? It is usually the incumbent wants to make it a choice between two candidates. I think the Democrat wants to make it a choice. Trump's flaws are manifest and many, and everyone knows what they are. And you're not going to, so you don't have to spend a lot of time convincing people why Trump is bad. You have to spend people convincing time why you are good. Like, so spend more time talking about yourself than Trump. I think the best candidate is someone who tells a broadly appealing, inspiring story about this moment in American history, and Trump is not a main character in that story.
And which candidate do you think is that?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. It's like some days I look at it and I'm like, Elizabeth Warren is amazing and she'd be the best nominee. Sometimes I look and say, Kamala Harris would be an amazing nominee. And like everyone, and I've done it, like most of the people on the debate stage on next Friday night, the 10 candidates who've made it, I've looked at one point and said, I see how they can do this. It's really early. Obama was puttering around, doing pretty poorly at this point in 2007, right? And so I honestly, if I had the answer, if I knew who could do it, I would get off the stage, I'd pack my bags, and I'd go to that campaign and try to help them win. But I don't know who that is yet.